Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Daniel R. Schwartz. Schwartz received his PhD from Brown University. He is currently the Frederick J. Whiten Professor of English Literature and the Stephen H. Weiss Presidential Fellow at Cornell University. He is the author of many important and well-received books, including Imagining the Holocaust, In Defense of Reading, Teaching Literature in the 21st Century, and his most recent is called End Times, Crisis and Turmoil at the New York Times, 1999 to 2009. It was published by Excelsior Editions, an imprint of SUNY Press. And welcome to the show, Dan.
It's a pleasure to be with you again.
Yeah, nice to see you. Now, we have to talk about this. You state in your intro that you are a lifelong New York Times reader. You're an addict. So what made you decide to write this book criticizing the New York Times in many ways?
Well, remember, my conclusion is that the Times is the worst newspaper in the world, except for all the others.
Right.
So really, it is not that critical of the Times. It points out some of the difficulties they've had in making a financial model that works. It talks about some of the shortcomings for which they've been criticized, such as the Jason Blair scandal and Judy Miller's writing about weapons of mass destruction when there were no weapons, and talks about how Keller knew before the 2004 election that the government was wiretapping American citizens, but he held that private. But I think, on the whole, it's a judicious look at the New York Times. I consider myself sort of the outsider ombudsman with insider knowledge. Mm-hmm. And the reason I say that is that the Times let me have some considerable access. I interviewed every living executive editor and many of the past and present luminaries, including masthead figures and section editors.
Mm-hmm. Did you have an agenda when you first started writing this? I know you started this in 2004. Were you just wanting to delve into what was happening in the digital age? You talk a lot about how the paper's having a hard time surviving.
Well, I had no business writing this book. It was a Don Quixote project when I started it in 2004. I had set a goal to write three books, one about New York, which was Damon Runyon, Broadway Boogie Woogie and the Making of New York City Culture, and the book on the Holocaust, and a book that related modern art to modern literature, Reconfiguring Modernism. So I was looking for a project, and I had been a lifelong reader of the Times. In fact, my dad had taught me to read on the Times. He started me with the numbers on sports and stocks.
Wow, that's like learning how to drive on a stick shift, isn't
Something
it?
Something like.
Very dense.
So the three things that I later found out that I needed, and I did get, were one, which I mentioned, access, that I was able to interview one-on-one in taped interviews many of the luminaries. And second of all, I didn't know anything about internet models, and I had to learn that. And the third thing I didn't know anything about was really business models for the media. So basically, by the time I wrote the book, I had what I needed. It was a very ambitious project, easily of the 15 books I've written, the most difficult.
Oh, absolutely. Well, let's talk in depth about some of this. Howell Raines, he became the managing editor right before 9/11. Talk to us about some of his mistakes and some of his triumphs.
Well, Raines was the executive editor at the time of 9/11. They won 7 Pulitzers for the coverage of that. And he was a hero in the Times building, at least to the business side. During his reign, Jason Blair was a young minority reporter who reported on the snipers in Washington in the early first decade of the 21st century. And it turned out his reporting bylines were filed from Maryland and D.C., but he never went there.
That was such a shocking case.
Right. So Raines was embarrassed by that in the eyes of the New York Times reporters and editors. But it ought to be said that Raines would never have had to resign had he not been strongly disliked by most of his staff. Had Rosenthal or Frankel had this reporter go astray, it wouldn't make any difference, a rogue reporter, we might call it. But this was kind of a pretext for basically a coup d'etat in the building. Why did they want to get rid of him? For one thing, he played favorites. He showed disdain for some of the people who had had the steam under his predecessor, Lelyveld, and the predecessor before that, Frankel. So he was a pretty arrogant fellow. I've interviewed him, and he's pretty convinced that he knows better than everybody else.
You also talked about how he put everything in war terms.
Oh.
And everything was this big Civil War kind of metaphors.
Right. Well, Raines conceives himself as a kind of liberal from the South, but he's very much comes from a Southern family, and he has on the wall of his farm his family heritage. He invited me down to the farm for what I thought would be an hour or two interview because he had heard that I was talking to some of his adversaries who had been part of deposing him. And I, as far as I know, was the first person to interview him on the farm from any place, press, outsider, insider. And he kept me there the whole day. He's an extremely loquacious man, and he told his story. And you're right, you've obviously read the book carefully, he likes to think of things in terms of war and military images.
And also football images you talked about, indeed.
Right. So everything is a contest. And
did he try to defend the Jason Blair situation? How did he angle that?
Well, by then the Judith Miller thing was also out. In other words, they passed the buck to other people to some extent. I mean, I think he would have a two-pronged defense. One is that he was very committed to minorities. One reason he was chosen as the editor by Sulzberger is he made a pitch to Sulzberger. He was actually at that time editorial page editor, and his title is executive editor. There is a managing editor. Mm-hmm. So to some extent, there was a managing editor named Boyd who he blamed it on, and to some extent, and the managing editor was also a minority person. But he also felt strongly that he was encouraging minorities and giving people second chances. But there is something of a paper record of people warning him that this guy Blair was irresponsible.
Yeah.
And
I mean,
possibly
they have to take responsibility for destroying some of the credibility of the Times,
right,
which still hasn't been recovered. I mean, really, that was the beginning of a decline.
Well, people have I think that what might be called a decline in the Times partly are some of these issues that we've mentioned. Obviously, Judith Miller wrote about weapons of mass destruction when there were none, and it gave coverage to the moderate Democrats to vote for the Iraq War. Basically, it was a situation where Hussein had a sign, "Beware of the dog," but there was no dog.
That's right.
And she wrote there was a dog. So that might have been the most important thing.
There was a string of things. Yeah. But how did Judith Miller get away with this? I mean, can you explain that to us?
Well,
why did she have such free rein?
There's a lot of backstories about that. I didn't get too much into this, but there's gossip about Judith Miller in the Times. She was very close to Arthur Sulzberger Jr., the current publisher, but she was thought to have very good sources in the government.
Mm-hmm.
She had been a partner of one of the Secretaries of Defense, supposedly. So she had a great deal of prestige, and nobody really reined her in. In fact, 2 days before she was let go, Dowd wrote a column called Women of Mass Destruction.
I was going to bring that up.
Right.
I mean, even her co-workers and her colleagues were turning on her.
There were a few people in that building that a lot of people are afraid and intimidated by, and we just named two. There's a lot of people who know that Dowd is not always on the money with her columns, but nobody in that building wants to say anything.
But do you think some of it has to do with sexism, though? I mean, there have traditionally not been a lot of women in powerful positions at the New York Times, you have to admit.
Well, this is true, but on the other hand, the answer to those particular two may not be, it's more complicated than that. I didn't talk about in my book, and I'm not going to talk in the air about some of the gossip surrounding Judy Miller, but there's no question that she had a great deal of privilege there. And yes, the Times has a history of sexism, but in this particular case, I'm not sure that the fact that Miller got a pass on everything. Because what the Miller issue really raised is something we might talk about, and that is, how do you deal with sourcing? most newspapers rely on sources that don't want to be acknowledged.
Right, so it's deep background.
Right, deep background. Sometimes the president or the secretary of state will not want to be quoted, and they'll say sources close to them.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
nobody really knew or admits to knowing where Miller was getting this information. And as a result of this, the Times put in much stricter sourcing. And supposedly, if you have a story, you have to tell a senior editor, and depending on the importance of it, all the way up the ladder to Sulzberger if you're sourcing.
Ah.
So, but there's no question that sourcing is abused. I mean, for example, within the last year, there was an article about a Brooklyn real estate person in the magazine section, and they were giving sources who were not be disclosed to making comments. That's ridiculous. If a source is in the Syrian government and doesn't want to be disclosed, we understand that, because if the person is disclosed, he might not have his head in 10 minutes. But where it's just gossip, sourcing is abused. And I talk about the abuse of sourcing in there.
And you talk about it a lot.
I have a whole chapter on Judy Miller, not with the gossip, but with what actually happened and what happened with Libby and why.
Well, let's talk about Bill Keller, too, who took over finally from Raines. And he brought a bit of a calm, but he had his own weaknesses. Talk to us about him.
Well, I think Bill Keller, as I say in the book, was a very good editor for the time. He doesn't have an enormous ego. He's a straight shooter. Raines took all the power to himself, and so he became the anti-Raines and gave section editors much more freedom.
Mm-hmm.
If he had a mistake, it's probably the wiretapping. There were a few other things that shouldn't have happened. For example, the implication that McCabe had had an affair with a lobbyist. That was a story that should never have been run, because they don't have proof. And if she didn't do anything wrong, and he didn't do anything wrong, that's between him and his wife. They never really proved anything there, and I had a lot of gossip. And in fact, on the internet site, they actually had a kind of more provocative picture with low-cut dress than they put in the paper. So that was ridiculous. And what happened with Duke LaCrosse was ridiculous, too. A bunch of people were making irresponsible statements about that. Yes, the boys who did that probably shouldn't hire a hooker to dance naked, and that's not so good. But again, that's between them and their parents.
Well,
you
talk more about this in the book, though. I mean, you feel like the New York Times in many ways has stooped to this kind of gossipy, trying to get younger readers lured in.
You know, we should talk a little bit about the changes in the Times.
We absolutely
The Times
will, yeah.
was once the paper of record. If you wanted to know what was going on in World War II, say the Normandy invasion, which I use as a point of departure, you looked at the Times. The only other reporting was on radio, and radio doesn't have maps. And you could go
and
to a newsreel.
Radio can't go into the detail either. Yeah.
So
absolutely.
The Times was the paper of record. What did that mean? It meant they disclosed what was going on the battlefield. It meant that they basically talked about what the government was doing. Sometimes they printed bills at length, at least versions of them. Mm-hmm. They told you who was in the cabinet of Panama, even if you didn't want to know. Yeah. In other words, it was the one daily history of the world. They even had on Saturday incoming and outgoing ships. Now what is it? Well, several things have changed. One, we don't need news, because those of us who are interested in news go on to the website all day. We have 24-hour news. So what do they stress? They obviously do news, and they do it in depth. And in fact, they've done very well with some of the stories about corruption in China.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Daniel Schwartz. We're talking about his new book, End Times, Crisis and Turmoil at the New York Times, 1999 to 2009. Do you want to talk about the fact that it did turn into a digital, they have a digital newspaper?
I'll talk about that in a minute. I think we should maybe talk about how the Times has changed. Why do you look at the Times? Because their analysis is better than anybody else. So they do that in depth. Two, they do what they call enterprise or investigatory journalism. For example, they can assign four people to a story and they come back in 4 months because they still have a staff of 1,100 reporters and news people and editors, and nobody else has
all
a fraction of that.
Still, right?
Yeah, we're going to get to that. Mm-hmm. And so that's good. For example, that story in the Long Island Railroad conductors, everyone who had retired from the Long Island Railroad had disability. They sent people around to look into records, the cahoots between yes. insurance companies and doctors. They followed some of these people with disability on the golf course and tennis racket. So they can do investigatory journalism. The third thing they do, and this answers your question to some extent about what the internet is also doing, they do what's called value-added journalism. Value-added journalism means how to buy a house, where to eat, how to live, how to take care of your aging parents, and
right.
can get down to
cultural stuff.
Yeah, it even can get down into nail polish. Some of this I call Times Light, that it has no. And so the fourth thing that they do that nobody else does, and this is important, they are the only source of foreign reporting in this country. You may see Anderson Cooper on the tarmac, but that's not the foreign reporting that really counts. In places like Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan, it is extraordinarily expensive to do this. You need not merely experienced reporters. You need embedded people who may not even be identified, who speak languages. You need translators. That's you need right. security people, safe houses. Sometimes when they sneak people into places like Syria, you need medical people.
Mm-hmm. But you also need people who are going to be telling the truth. And I think the Times has lost some of its stature as the, you know, the paper of record because of some of these other stories.
Well, it's a different, we should talk. Truth is a much more up for grabs, Tish.
You think so, just like history is, huh?
Well, let's put it this way. We mentioned deliberately the Normandy invasion. During World War II, during the Cold War, the government and the press, most of the media, there were outriders, you know, like Father Coughlin, most people were generally agreed upon American values. For example, when the administration wanted to leak a story, they called the ALSOP, so they called Reston
That's right.
or Kroc. So
That's right.
there was very, one of the things we see in this era is a kind of division, a kind of opening schism that's gone on for a long time. It started with the Cuban Missile Crisis, where some of the press felt they had been tricked by Kennedy. And of course, it became exacerbated during the Vietnam War and the Pentagon
was
papers,
huge.
But also Watergate. And now there's a great deal of suspicion on the part of the press and the media to the government. And of course, the internet, which you mentioned before, has opened this up. Everybody can get on and say so-and-so is a liar, so-and-so is a crook.
That's right. And then they can write their own version of
right.
things.
Well, you know, one of the things I wanted to say about foreign news, 26 bureaus the Times has, and whenever you read about foreign news, whether it's on MSNBC or Fox, they're just putting a spin on the New York Times.
Yeah.
In fact, one of the problems for the New York Times is the business model. Print advertising brings in more revenue than internet advertising. For example, if you see an ad on Marriott on the New York Times site, you're going to just go to the Marriott site. Why read a couple of words when you can go to the site? So basically on the internet, a company competes with itself.
Mm.
So who's going to pay a lot for advertising? And so that's a problem. And a second problem we sort of alluded to, if the Times is probably going to survive as a news source in the long term, people are going to have to share their costs. There is something called the Times News Bureau, and local papers pay them a little bit here and there.
Mm-hmm.
But the basic cost of foreign news, in my judgment, will have to be shared. And that means that the major TV networks, cable networks, people who use it. What do you think Huffington Post pays the Times for their stories? The answer is exactly nothing, as far as I know. You know, these blogospheres, it's just, you know, this is stealing.
So you're saying that in order for the New York Times to survive, they are going to have to be paid by all these sources that use them as the paper of record,
Well, you know, I talked
in
that Huffington Post piece I did a few weeks ago about what are some of the models for survival. I mean, is there going to be a print newspaper? Can it even survive as a news gathering?
Well, I was going to ask you, what do you think? I mean, Do you think people are going to continue reading a newspaper? And do people even care anymore?
Well, one of the things that we know, is that A, people spend less time with newspaper, and B, fewer people read it. I mean, it's worth thinking about the Facebook IPO, which came, the Facebook IPO, now the stock came out at 38, now as last I heard it was 32, but even at 32, it's one of the 30 biggest companies in the country. I mean, the Times is capitalization now. That's capitalization, not to get too complicated, it's the stock price plus the number of shares. Mm. The Times capitalization is less than $1 billion. Even with the bumps that the IPO has, as of this morning, the Facebook IPO was worth $87 billion. That is very interesting.
That is very interesting.
Because what am I saying? I'm saying something quite this. Many people, possibly because of cynicism to the various wars in Iraq, possibly because of politics, seem to be more interested in what I call micro news. There's national news, the U.S. There's international news, which we just talked about. There's local news, which we think of as what's going on in Ithaca. There's micro news. And as I said to you before we started, partly for my book, I just went on Facebook for the first time in the last 10 days. I get on Facebook from various people how their dog is doing.
Oh, absolutely.
What the dog is eating.
So that's what you call micro news,
that's
right?
Micro. And there's one person there who tells me all day what she's listening to.
And people, they post pictures of their dinners. And
right.
Wait till you get on there for a while.
I know. So this is what's called, and so it's the value, though, that our culture is putting on a major news gathering operation. The Times is in deep trouble.
Yeah.
I mean, their financial reports are always overly optimistic, but in fact, they're not making money.
Well, let's talk about the fact that we really need freedom of the press, and we need a real functioning press in a democracy in order for it to
right.
thrive. So what do we do? Do we need to re-educate people about the importance of a free press?
Well, I think there is a trade-off. I think things like Facebook take my students to say that some of the time, a good piece of their time is on social media with Facebook and their apps. When I was growing up, we read the newspaper. I mean, on Sunday, when the Times came, everybody got up early, grabbed the section, and we didn't, you know, no activities were done for several hours. That was
I think some people still do that.
So I think that there's something going on where people are more interested in local news and their friends, and what they call friends, because I'm not sure
what
anyone
you call
can have
micro,
200 friends. I mean, really, that kind of connection means more now than proposing what we ought to do about major issues. Clearly, there are still people interested in that. But sometimes you wonder how informed they are. I mean, when you see some of the debates between various factions, say the people at the Tea Party don't, you often, in my judgment, don't know what they're talking about. But on the other hand, when I went down to the Wall Street thing, some of those people don't know what they're talking about, too. I mean, some of their supporters are Rand Paul people and Ron Paul people. So what I see, even among my best students, is that being informed is not a value.
Yeah, and people just want to reiterate their own beliefs
right.
instead of find the truth.
Well,
in
that's
things.
True. That is, reiterating beliefs is very much part of the blogosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And you can say whatever you want.
Yeah.
I remember I talked about how there was a kind of confluence of belief between most people, say, in the 40s and the 50s. I mean, we forget Sulzberger really drafted Eisenhower. I mean, they didn't know if he was a Democrat or a Republican. There was much more, a much less vitriolic discourse. And we, you know, the part of what contributes to that are some of the is Fox News and some of the right-wing pundits. But Oberman does his share, too. It's just the media's performance, Look how CNN has evolved from really news gathering
just
to, you know, to feature.
It's turned into an entertainment network.
Well, yeah, I mean,
more so than it used to be.
Much more so.
So
I think that, will the Times survive is the question we might take up.
When you talk to some of the people and conducted those interviews with people who are right now working in the Times, what did you talk about that? Do they think it'll survive?
The answer is yes. I think, first of all, the people in the Times are in general extremely impressive people.
Mm.
They are, they even have something in common. They're very competitive, they're very ambitious, they're very smart, they're very hardworking, most of them. And I came away with a great deal of admiration for many of them. Some of them I admired that I didn't particularly like, some of them, but on the whole, they were very impressive. And if somebody read my book very carefully and I gave them a quiz, you can see I had one person who was extremely helpful, who was one of the major people. He was fourth on the masthead, and he was very helpful. And he'd answer my emails at any hour of the day and night in 1 minute. So I had somebody who was extremely helpful.
And so they think the paper will survive, the people who are inside.
Well, there are two questions, of course. Will it survive as we know it? Will it survive as a newspaper? Probably in the long run, that's a problem. I think I propose that maybe there'll be some interim period where they'll publish something like the International Herald Tribune.
You mentioned that in your conclusion,
That's one possible model. And then the soft, what they call the magazine-y stuff, or soft sections, by which they mean home and style. Dining would be on another day.
So that
would
be like the USA Today almost.
Well, no, it wouldn't.
In some ways.
No, I don't think so. Because the International Herald Tribune is a wonderful paper.
I used to read it when I lived in Europe.
It's wonderful.
Absolutely.
And I think it's not going to be like...
No, but I'm talking about if you had separate papers just with styles and, homes and...
Separate magazine, so they could keep...
Okay.
In other words, what the International Tribune does is... print a few highlights from the magazine section, and they could still do that. But if someone wanted the New York Times magazine, which would be not the Sunday magazine but the soft sections, they could buy it on a daily or a weekly basis. Another thing is, people have proposed maybe it will turn out to be like PBS or NPR, that it'll be nonprofit. Problem with that, of course, is that everybody who contributes wants a say. PBS, of course, the people sort of contribute, but they all argue about who should be controlling it, and the congressmen get on the floor and say there's no...
Dan, we are almost out of time. Do you want to give us a little concluding sentence about how you feel about this subject?
Well, my book talks about starts with a history. It talks about all the major issues. It talks about whether the Times will survive, how it could survive. It talks about the business model, who could buy it, how that would turn out, because actually at under $1 billion, it's not very expensive, not for me or you. But what I would say is the Times is the best newspaper in the world, and it has a wonderful capacity for analysis. It does a great deal. It's very positive. And to support it, it relies on some of these soft sections, these magazine sections, and on Times Light. Is there a viable economic model? I'm not sure. I don't think anybody can be sure.
Well, Dan Schwartz, thank you so much for joining us. It's a fascinating book. I really recommend people go out and get it. It has to do with our lives, after all. It's called End Times, Crisis and Turmoil at the New York Times, 1999 to 2009. And it's available on Amazon and at your local bookstore. Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.